industry. On a superficial level, it does seem perverse that sick people have the most trouble getting health insurance. But imagine if insurance companies did not have that legal privilege. A highly contrived conversation with your doctor might go something like this. Doctor,
I'm afraid I have bad news. Four of your coronary arteries are fully or partially blocked. I would recommend open heart surgery as soon as possible.
Patient, is it likely to be successful?
Doctor, yes, we have excellent outcomes.
Patient, is the operation expensive?
Doctor, of course it's expensive. We're talking about open heart surgery.
Patient, then I should probably buy some health insurance first.
Doctor, yes, that would be a very good idea.
Insurance companies ask applicants questions about family history, health habits, smoking, dangerous hobbies, and all kinds of other personal things. When I applied for term life insurance, a representative for the company came to my house and drew blood to make sure that I was not HIV positive. He asked whether my parents were alive, if I scuba dive, if I race cars. Yes, yes, no. I peed in the cup, I got on a scale, I answered questions about tobacco and illicit drug use, all of which seemed reasonable given that the company was making a commitment to pay my wife a large sum of money should I die in the near future. Insurance companies have another subtle tool. They can design policies or screening mechanisms that elicit information from their potential customers. This insight, which is applicable to all kinds of other markets, earned Joseph Stiglitz, an economist at Columbia University and a former chief economist of the World Bank, a share of the 2001 Nobel Prize. How do firms screen customers in the insurance business? They use a deductible. Customers who consider themselves likely to stay healthy will sign up for policies that have a high deductible. In exchange, they're offered cheaper premiums. Customers who privately know that they're likely to have costly bills will avoid the deductible and pay a higher premium as a result. The same thing is true when you're shopping for car insurance and you have a sneaking suspicion that your 16-year-old son is an even worse driver than most 16-year-olds. In short, the deductible is a tool for teasing out private information. It forces customers to sort themselves. Any insurance question ultimately begs one explosive question. How much information is too much? I guarantee that this will become one of the most nettlesome policy problems in coming years. Here's a simple exercise. Pluck one hair from your head. If you're totally bald, take a swab of saliva from your cheek. That sample contains your entire genetic code. In the right hands or the wrong hands, it can be used to determine if you're predisposed to heart disease, certain kinds of cancer, depression, and, if the science continues at its current blistering pace, all kinds of other diseases. With one strand of your hair, a researcher or insurance company may soon be able to determine if you are at risk for Alzheimer's disease, 25 years before the onset of the disease. This creates a dilemma. If genetic information is shared widely with insurance companies, then it will become difficult, if not impossible, for those most prone to illness to get any kind of coverage. In other words, the people who need health insurance most will be the least likely to get it. Not just the night before surgery, but ever. Individuals with a family history of Huntington's disease, a hereditary degenerative brain disorder that causes premature death, are already finding it hard or impossible to get life insurance. On the other hand, new laws are forbidding insurance companies from gathering such information, leaving them vulnerable to serious adverse selection. Individuals who know that they're at high risk of getting sick in the future will be the ones who load up on generous insurance policies. An editorial in The Economist noted this looming quandary. Governments thus face a choice between banning the use of test results and destroying the industry, or allowing their use and creating an underclass of people who are either uninsurable or cannot afford to insure themselves. The Economist, which is hardly a bastion of left-wing thought, suggested that the private health insurance market may eventually find this problem intractable, leaving government with a much larger role to play. The editorial concluded, indeed, genetic testing may become the most potent argument for state-financed universal health care. Any health care reform that seeks to make health insurance both more accessible and more affordable, particularly for those who are sick or likely to get sick, will have devastating adverse selection problems. Think about it. If I promise that you can buy affordable insurance regardless of whether or not you're already sick, then the optimal time to buy that insurance is in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. The only fix for this inherent problem is to combine guaranteed access to affordable insurance with a requirement that everyone buy insurance, healthy and sick, young and old, a so-called personal mandate. The insurance companies will still lose money on the policies that they're forced to sell to bad risks, but those losses can be offset by the profits earned from healthy people who are forced to buy insurance. Any country with a national health care system effectively has a personal mandate. All citizens are forced to pay taxes, and in return, they all get government-funded health care. This is the approach that Massachusetts took as part of a state plan to provide universal access to health insurance. State residents who can afford health insurance but don't buy it are fined on their state tax return. Hillary Clinton supported a personal mandate in the 2008 Democratic presidential primaries. Barack Obama did not, though that arguably had more to do with distinguishing himself from his toughest Democratic opponent than it did with his analysis of adverse selection. Obviously, forcing healthy people to buy something that they would otherwise not buy is a heavy-handed use of government. It's also the only way to pool risk, which is the purpose of insurance, when the distribution of risk is not random. Here are the relevant economics. 1. We know who is sick. 2. Increasingly, we know who will become sick. 3. Sick people can be extremely expensive. And 4. Private insurance doesn't work well under these circumstances. That's all straightforward. The tough part is philosophical, ideological. To what extent do we want to share healthcare expenses anyway, if at all, and how should we do it? Those were the fundamental questions when Bill Clinton sought to overhaul healthcare in 1993, and again when the Obama administration took it up in 2009. This chapter started with the most egregious information-related problems. Cases in which missing information cripples markets and causes individuals to behave in ways that have serious social implications. Economists are also intrigued by more mundane examples of how markets react to missing information. We spend our lives shopping for products and services whose quality we cannot easily determine. You had to pay for this book before you were able to read it. In the vast majority of cases, consumers and firms create their own mechanisms to solve information problems. Indeed, therein lies the genius of McDonald's that inspired the title of this chapter. The Golden Arches have as much to do with information as they do with hamburgers. Every McDonald's hamburger tastes the same, whether it's sold in Moscow, Mexico City, or Cincinnati. That is not a mere curiosity. It's at the heart of the company's success. Suppose you're driving along Interstate 80 outside of Omaha, having never been in the state of Nebraska, when you see a McDonald's. Immediately you know all kinds of things about the restaurant. You know that it'll be clean, safe, and inexpensive. You know that it'll have a working bathroom. You know that it'll be open 7 days a week. You may even know how many pickles are on the double cheeseburger. You know all of these things before you get out of your car in a state you've never been in. Compare that to the billboard advertising Chuck's Big Burger. Chuck's may offer one of the best burgers west of the Mississippi. Or it might be a likely spot for the nation's next large E. coli outbreak. How would you know? If you lived in Omaha, then you might be familiar with Chuck's reputation, but you don't. You're driving through Nebraska at 9 o'clock at night. What time does Chuck's close, anyway? If you're like millions of other people, even those who find fast food relatively unappealing, you'll seek out the Golden Arches because you know what lies beneath them. McDonald's sells hamburgers, fries, and, most importantly, predictability. This idea underlies the concept of branding, whereby companies spend enormous sums of money to build an identity for their products. Branding solves a problem for consumers. How do you select products whose quality or safety you can determine only after you use them, and sometimes not even then? Hamburgers are just one example. The same rule applies in everything, from vacations to fashion. Will you have fun on your cruise? Yes, because it's Royal Caribbean, or Celebrity, or Viking, or Cunard. I have a poor sense of fashion, so I'm reassured that when I buy a Tommy Hilfiger shirt, I'll look reasonably presentable when I leave the house. Michelin tire advertisements feature babies playing inside of Michelin tires with the tagline, "Because so much is riding on your tires." The implicit message is clear enough. Meanwhile, Firestone has most likely destroyed much of the value of its brand as the result of the link between faulty tires and deadly rollovers in Ford Explorers. Branding has come under assault as a tool by which avaricious multinational corporations persuade us to pay extortionate premiums for goods that we don't need. Economics tells a different story. Branding helps to provide an element of trust that's necessary for a complex economy to function. Modern business requires that we conduct major transactions with people whom we've never met before. I regularly mail off checks to Fidelity, even though I do not know a single person at the company. Harried government regulators can only protect me from the most egregious kinds of fraud. They do not protect me from shoddy business practices, many of which are perfectly legal. Businesses routinely advertise their longevity. That sign outside the butcher, proclaiming since 1927, is a politic way of saying, "We wouldn't still be here if we ripped off our customers." Brands do the same thing. Like reputations, they're built over time. Indeed, sometimes the brand becomes more valuable than the product itself. In 1997, Sara Lee, a company that sells everything from underwear to breakfast sausages, declared that it would begin selling off its manufacturing facilities. No more turkey farms or textile mills. Instead, the company would focus on attaching its prestigious brand names, Champion, Hanes, Coach, Jimmy Dean, to products manufactured by outside firms. One business magazine noted, "Sara Lee believes that its soul is in its brands, and that the best use of its energies is to breathe commercial life into the inert matter supplied by others." The irony is lovely. Sara Lee's strategy for growth and profits is to produce nothing. Branding can be a very profitable strategy. In competitive markets, prices are driven relentlessly toward the cost of production. If it costs 10 cents to make a can of soda, and I sell it for $1, someone's going to come along and sell it for 50 cents. Soon enough, someone else will be peddling it for a quarter, then 15 cents. Eventually, some ruthlessly efficient corporation will be peddling soda for 11 cents a can. From the consumer standpoint, this is the beauty of capitalism. From the producer's standpoint, it is commodity hell. Consider the sorry lot of the American farmer. A soybean is a soybean. As a result, an Iowa farmer cannot charge even one penny above the market price for his crop. Once transportation costs are taken into account, every soybean in the world sells for the same price, which in most years is not a whole lot more than it costs to produce. How does a firm save its profits from the death spiral of competition? By convincing the world, rightfully or not, that its mixture of corn syrup and water is different from everyone else's mixture of corn syrup and water. Coca-Cola is not soda. It's Coke. Producers of branded goods create a monopoly for themselves and price their products accordingly by persuading consumers that their products are like no other. Nike clothes are not pieces of fabric sewn together by workers in Vietnam. They are Tiger Woods clothes. Even farmers have taken this message to heart. At the supermarket, one finds and pays a premium for sun-kissed oranges, Angus beef, Tyson chickens. Sometimes we gather information by paying outsiders to certify quality. Roger Ebert's job is to see lots of bad movies so that I don't have to. When he sees the occasional gem, he gives it a thumbs up. In the meantime, I'm spared from seeing the likes of Tomcats, a film that Mr. Ebert awarded 0 stars. I pay for this information in the form of my subscription to the Chicago Sun-Times, or by looking at ads that the Sun-Times is paid to display on its free website. Consumer Reports provides the same kind of information on consumer goods. Underwriters Laboratory certifies the safety of electrical appliances. Morningstar evaluates the performance of mutual funds. And then there is Oprah's Book Club, which has the capacity to send obscure books rocketing up the bestseller lists. Meanwhile, firms will do whatever they can to signal their own quality to the market. This was the insight of 2001 Nobel laureate Michael Spence, an economist at Stanford University. Suppose that you're choosing an investment advisor after a good stroke of fortune in the Powerball lottery. The first firm you visit has striking wood paneling, a marble lobby, original impressionist paintings, and executives wearing handmade Italian suits. Do you think, one, my fees will pay for all this very nice stuff? What a rip-off! Or, two, wow, this firm must be extremely successful, and I hope they'll take me on as a client. Most people would choose two. If you're not convinced, think about it the other way. How would you feel if your investment advisor worked in a dank office with 20-year-old government surplus Wang word processors? The trappings of success, the paneling, the marble, the art collection, have no inherent relation to the professional conduct of the firm. Rather, we interpret them as signals that reassure us that the firm is top-notch. They are to markets what a peacock's bright feathers are to a prospective mate, a good sign in a world of imperfect information. What signals success when you walk into an office in parts of Asia? Ridiculously cold temperatures. The blast of frigid air tells you immediately that this firm can afford lots of air conditioning. Even when the temperature is more than 90 degrees outside, office temperatures are sometimes so cold that some workers use space heaters. The Wall Street Journal reports, "Frosty air conditioning is a way for businesses and building owners to show that they're ahead of the curve on comfort." In ostentatious Asian cities, bosses like to send out the message, "We are so luxurious, we're Arctic." Here's a related question that economists like to ponder. Harvard graduates do very well in life, but is that because they learned things at Harvard that made them successful? Or is it because Harvard finds and admits talented students who would have done extraordinarily well in life anyway? In other words, does Harvard add great value to its students, or does it simply provide an elaborate signaling mechanism that allows bright students to advertise their talents to the world by being admitted to Harvard? Alan Krueger, a Princeton economist, and Stacy Dale, an economist at the Mellon Foundation, have done an interesting study to get at this question. They note that graduates of highly selective colleges earn higher salaries later in life than graduates of less selective colleges. For example, the average student who entered Yale, Swarthmore, or the University of Pennsylvania in 1976 earned $92,000 in 1995. The average student who entered a moderately selective college, such as Penn State, Denison or Tulane earn $22,000 less. That is not a particularly surprising finding, nor does it get at the question of whether the students at schools like Yale and Princeton would earn more than their peers at less competitive schools, even if they played beer pong and watched television for 4 years. So Mr. Kruger and Ms. Dale took their analysis one step further. They examined the outcomes of students who were admitted to both a highly selective school and a moderately selective school. Some of those students headed to places like the Ivy League. Others chose their less selective option. Mr. Kruger and Ms. Dale's chief finding is best summarized by the title of the chapter. Children smart enough to get into elite schools may not need to bother. The average earnings of students admitted to both a highly selective school and a moderately selective school were roughly the same, regardless of which type of college they attended. The one exception was students from lower-income families for whom attending a more selective school increased earnings significantly. Overall, the quality of student appears to matter more later in life than the quality of the university he or she attended. Is it irrational to spend $150,000 or more to attend an Ivy League university? Not necessarily. At a minimum, a Princeton or Yale diploma is the resume equivalent of Roger Ebert's thumbs up. It pronounces you highly qualified so that others in life, employers, spouses, in-laws, will have fewer doubts. And there's always the possibility that you may learn something while huddling for 4 years with the world's great minds. Still, Mr. Kruger offers this advice to students applying to college. Don't believe that the only school worth attending is one that would not admit you. Recognize that your own motivation, ambition, and talents will determine your success more than the college name on your diploma. The notion that bright, motivated individuals with similarly motivated parents will do well, however or wherever they're schooled, is often lost on America's school reformers. In Illinois, each fall is greeted with the release of the state's school report cards. Every school in the state is evaluated based on how well its students have performed on a battery of standardized exams. The media quickly seize on these school report cards to identify the state's best schools, most of which are usually in affluent suburbs. But does this process really tell us anything about which schools are the most effective? Not necessarily. In many suburban communities, students would do well on standardized tests even if they went to school and sat in a closet every day for 4 years, says University of Rochester economist Eric Hanushek, an expert on the somewhat tenuous relationship between school inputs and student outcomes. There's a fundamental piece of missing information. How much value is really being added at these high-performing schools? Do they have exceptional teachers and administrators? Or are they repositories for privileged students who would do well on standardized tests regardless of where they went to school? It's the Harvard question all over again. This chapter started with a serious social issue, and so it will end. Racial profiling is an information problem. There are two simple questions at the heart of the issue. First, does race or ethnicity, alone or in conjunction with some other circumstance, convey meaningful information related to potential criminal activity? If so, what do we do about it? The answer to the first question gets most of the attention. After the attacks of September 11th, one could certainly make the case that 35-year-old Arab men posed a greater risk to the country than 65-year-old Polish women. Police officers have long argued that race can be a tip-off. Well-dressed white kids in poor black neighborhoods are often looking to buy drugs. Criminal organizations have racial or ethnic affiliations. At the same time President Clinton was declaring racial profiling morally indefensible, the website of his drug czar, Barry McCaffrey, was doing just that. In Denver, the site noted, the heroin dealers are predominantly Mexican nationals. In Trenton, crack dealers are predominantly African-American males, and the powdered cocaine dealers are predominantly Latino. Indeed, we all profile in our own way. We're taught from a young age that one should never judge a book by its cover. But we must. It's often all we get to see. Imagine you're walking in a parking garage at night when you hear footsteps behind you. Ideally, you'd ask this person for a resume. You and he would sit down for coffee and discuss his goals, his job, his family, his political philosophy, and most important, the reason he's walking behind you in a dark parking garage. You'd do a criminal background check. Then, with all this information in hand, you'd decide whether or not to hit the panic button on your key ring. The reality, of course, is different. You get one quick glance over your shoulder. What information matters? Sex, race, age, briefcase, clothing? I'll never forget my own experience as a victim of racial profiling. I boarded a westbound bus from downtown Chicago just as it started to get dark. Chicago is a very segregated city. Most of the neighborhoods west of downtown are predominantly African-American. I was wearing a suit, and after a few blocks, I was the only white guy on the bus. Around that time, an older black woman asked kindly, "Oh, are the Bulls playing tonight?" The Chicago Bulls play at the Chicago Stadium, which is also directly west of the city center. This woman had inferred, innocently enough, that the only reason a white guy in a suit would be on this bus around 7 p.m. would be to go to a Bulls game. Obviously, it was unfair and potentially hurtful for her to draw any conclusion about my destination based only on my skin color and style of dress. The really weird thing is that I was on my way to the Bulls game. Race, age, ethnicity, and/or country of origin can convey information in some circumstances, particularly when other, better information is lacking. From a social policy standpoint, however, the fact that these attributes may convey meaningful information is a red herring. The question that matters is, are we willing to systematically harass individuals who fit a broad racial or ethnic profile that may, on average, have some statistical support, but will still be wrong far more often than it is right? Most people would answer no in most circumstances. We've built a society that values civil liberties even at the expense of social order. Opponents of racial profiling always seem to get dragged into the quagmire of whether or not it's good police work or an effective counterterrorism tool. That's not the only relevant point, and it may be completely irrelevant in some cases. If economics teaches us anything, it's that we ought to weigh costs and benefits. The costs of harassing 10 or 20 or 100 law-abiding people to catch one more drug dealer are not worth it. Terrorism is trickier because the potential costs of letting just one person slip through the cracks are so devastatingly high. So what exactly should we do about it? That is one of the tough trade-offs in the post-September 11th world. In the world of Econ 101, all parties have perfect information. The graphs are neat and tidy. Consumers and producers know everything they could possibly want to know. The world outside of Econ 101 is more interesting, albeit messier. A state patrolman who was pulled over a 1990 Grand Am with a broken taillight on a deserted stretch of Florida highway does not have perfect information. Nor does a young family looking for a safe and dependable nanny, or an insurance company seeking to protect itself from the extraordinary costs of HIV/AIDS. Information matters. Economists study what we do with it, and sometimes, more important, what we do without it. Chapter 6. Productivity and Human Capital. Why is Bill Gates so much richer than you are? Like many people, Bill Gates found his house a little cramped once he had children. The software mogul moved into his $100 million mansion in 1997. Not long after, it needed some tweaking. The 37,000-square-foot home has a 20-seat theater, a reception hall, parking for 28 cars, an indoor trampoline pit, and all kinds of computer gadgetry, such as phones that ring only when the person being called is nearby. But the house was not quite big enough. According to documents filed with the zoning board in suburban Medina, Washington, Mr. Gates and his wife added another bedroom and some additional play and study areas for their children. There are a lot of things one might infer from Mr. Gates' home addition, but one of them is fairly obvious. It is good to be Bill Gates. The world is a fascinating playground when you have $50 billion or so. One might also ponder some larger questions. Why do some people have indoor trampolines and private jets, while others sleep in bus station bathrooms? How is it that roughly 13% of Americans are poor? Which is an improvement from a recent peak of 15% in 1993, but not significantly better than it was during any year in the 1970s. Meanwhile, 1 in 5 American children and a staggering 35% of black children live in poverty. Of course, America is the rich guy on the block. At the dawn of the third millennium, vast swaths of the world's population, some 3 billion people, are desperately poor. Economists study poverty and income inequality. They seek to understand who is poor, why they're poor, and what can be done about it. Any discussion of why Bill Gates is so much richer than the men and women sleeping in steam tunnels must begin with a concept economists refer to as human capital. Human capital is the sum total of skills embodied within an individual: education, intelligence, charisma, creativity, work experience, entrepreneurial vigor, even the ability to throw a baseball fast. It's what you'd be left with if someone stripped away all of your assets, your job, your money, your home, your possessions, and left you on a street corner with only the clothes on your back. How would Bill Gates fare in such a situation? Very well. Even if his wealth were confiscated, other companies would snap him up as a consultant, a board member, a CEO, a motivational speaker. When Steve Jobs was fired from Apple, the company that he founded, he turned around and founded Pixar. Only later did Apple invite him back. How would Tiger Woods do? Just fine. If someone lent him golf clubs, he could be winning a tournament by the weekend. How would Bubba, who dropped out of school in 10th grade and has a methamphetamine addiction, fare? Not so well. The difference is human capital. Bubba doesn't have much. Ironically, some very rich individuals, such as the Sultan of Brunei, might not do particularly well in this exercise either. The Sultan is rich because his kingdom sits atop an enormous oil reserve. The labor market is no different from the market for anything else. Some kinds of talent are in greater demand than others. The more nearly unique a set of skills, the better compensated their owner will be. Alex Rodriguez will earn $275 million over 10 years playing baseball for the New York Yankees because he can hit a round ball traveling 90-plus miles an hour harder and more often than other people can. A-Rod will help the Yankees win games, which will fill stadiums, sell merchandise, and earn television revenues. Virtually no one else on the planet can do that as well as he can. As with other aspects of the market economy, the price of a certain skill bears no inherent relation to its social value, only its scarcity. I once interviewed Robert Solow, winner of the 1987 Nobel Prize in Economics, and a noted baseball enthusiast. I asked if it bothered him that he received less money for winning the Nobel Prize than Roger Clemens, who was pitching for the Red Sox at the time, earned in a single season. "No," Solow said. "There are a lot of good economists, but there is only one Roger Clemens. That is how economists think. Who is wealthy in America, or at least comfortable? Software programmers, hand surgeons, nuclear engineers, writers, accountants, bankers, teachers. Sometimes these individuals have natural talent. More often, they've acquired their skills through specialized training and education. In other words, they have made significant investments in human capital. Like any other kind of investment, from building a manufacturing plant to buying a bond, money invested today in human capital will yield a return in the future. A very good return. A college education is reckoned to yield about a 10% return on investment, meaning that if you put down money today for college tuition, you can expect to earn that money back plus about 10% a year in higher earnings. Few people on Wall Street make better investments than that on a regular basis. Human capital is an economic passport, literally in some cases. When I was an undergraduate in the late 1980s, I met a young Palestinian man named Gamal Abu Ali. Gamal's family, who lived in Kuwait, were insistent that their son finish his degree in 3 years instead of four. This required taking extra classes each quarter and attending school every summer, all of which seemed rather extreme to me at the time. What about internships and foreign study, or even a winter in Colorado as a ski bum? I had lunch with Gamal's father once, and he explained that the Palestinian existence was itinerant and precarious. Mr. Abu Ali was an accountant, a profession that he could practice nearly anywhere in the world, because, he explained, that is where he might end up. The family had lived in Canada before moving to Kuwait. They could easily be somewhere else in 5 years, he said. Gamal was studying engineering, a similarly universal skill. The sooner he had his degree, his father insisted, the more secure he'd be. Not only would the degree allow him to earn a living, but it might also enable him to find a home. In some developed countries, the right to immigrate is based on skills and education, human capital. Mr. Abu Ali's thoughts were strikingly prescient. After Saddam Hussein's retreat from Kuwait in 1990, most of the Palestinian population, including Gamal's family, was expelled because the Kuwaiti government felt that the Palestinians had been sympathetic to the Iraqi aggressors. Mr. Abu Ali's daughter gave him a copy of the first edition of this book. When he read the above section, he exclaimed, "See, I was right." The opposite is true at the other end of the labor pool. The skills necessary to ask, "Would you like fries with that?" are not scarce. There are probably 150 million people in America capable of selling value meals at McDonald's. Fast food restaurants need only pay a wage high enough to put warm bodies behind all of their cash registers. That may be $7.25 an hour when the economy is slow, or $11 an hour when the labor market is especially tight. It'll never be $500 an hour, which is the kind of fee that a top trial lawyer can command. Excellent trial lawyers are scarce. Burger flippers are not. The most insightful way to think about poverty in this country or anywhere else in the world is as a dearth of human capital. True. People are poor in America because they cannot find good jobs. But that's the symptom, not the illness. The underlying problem is a lack of skills or human capital. The poverty rate for high school dropouts in America is 12 times the poverty rate for college graduates. Why is India one of the poorest countries in the world? Primarily because 35% of the population is illiterate, down from almost 50% in the early 1990s. Or individuals may suffer from conditions that render their human capital less useful. A high proportion of America's homeless population suffers from substance abuse, disability, or mental illness. A healthy economy matters too. It was easier to find a job in 2001 than it was in 1975 or 1932. A rising tide does indeed lift all boats. Economic growth is a very good thing for poor people, period. But even at high tide, low-skilled workers are clinging to driftwood while their better-skilled peers are having cocktails on their yachts. A robust economy does not transform valet parking attendants into college professors. Investments in human capital do that. Macroeconomic factors control the tides. Human capital determines the quality of the boat. Conversely, a bad economy is usually most devastating for workers at the shallow end of the labor pool. Consider this thought experiment. Imagine that on some Monday morning, we dropped off 100,000 high school dropouts on the corner of State Street and Madison Street in Chicago. It would be a social calamity. Government services would be stretched to capacity or beyond. Crime would go up. Businesses would be deterred from locating in downtown Chicago. Politicians would plead for help from the state or the federal government. Either give us enough money to support these people or help us get rid of them. When business leaders in Sacramento, California decided to crack down on the homeless, one strategy was to offer them one-way bus tickets out of town. Atlanta reportedly did the same before the 1996 Olympics. Now imagine the same corner, and let's drop off 100,000 graduates from America's top universities. The buses arrive at the corner of State and Madison and begin unloading lawyers, doctors, artists, geneticists, software engineers, and a lot of smart, motivated people with general skills. Many of these individuals would find jobs immediately. Remember, human capital embodies not only classroom training, but also perseverance, honesty, creativity, virtues that lend themselves to finding work. Some of these highly skilled graduates would start their own businesses. Entrepreneurial flair is certainly an important component of human capital. Some of them would leave for other places. Highly skilled workers are more mobile than their low-skilled peers. In some cases, firms would relocate to Chicago or open up offices and plants in Chicago to take advantage of this temporary glut of talent. Economic pundits would later describe this freak unloading of buses as a boon for Chicago's economic development, much as waves of immigration helped America to develop. If this example sounds contrived, consider the case of the Naval Air Warfare Center, or NAWC, in Indianapolis, a facility that produced advanced electronics for the Navy until the late 1990s. NAWC, which employed roughly 2,600 workers, was slated to be closed as part of the military's downsizing. We're all familiar with these plant closing stories. Hundreds or thousands of workers lose their jobs. Businesses in the surrounding community begin to wither because so much purchasing power has been lost. Someone comes on camera and says, "When the plant closed back in, pick a year, this town just began to die." But NAWC was a very different story. One of its most valuable assets was its workforce, some 40% of whom were scientists or engineers. Astute local leaders, led by Mayor Stephen Goldsmith, believed that the plant could be sold to a private buyer. Seven companies filed bids. Hughes Electronics was the winner. On a Friday in January 1997, the NAWC employees went home as government employees. The following Monday, 98% of them came to work as Hughes employees, and NAWC became HAWC. The Hughes executives I interviewed said that the value of the acquisition lay in the people, not just in the bricks and mortar. Hughes was buying a massive amount of human capital that it could not easily find anywhere else. This story contrasts sharply with the plant closings that Bruce Springsteen sings about, where workers with limited education find that their narrow sets of skills have no value once the mill, mine, factory, plant is gone. The difference is human capital. Indeed, economists can even provide empirical support for those Springsteen songs. Labor economist Robert Toppel has estimated that experienced workers lose 25% of their earnings capacity in the long run when they're forced to change jobs by a plant closing. Now is an appropriate time to dispatch one of the most pernicious notions in public policy, the lump of labor fallacy. This is the mistaken belief that there's a fixed amount of work to be done in the economy, and therefore every new job must come at the expense of a job lost somewhere else. If I am unemployed, the mistaken argument goes, then I'll find work only if someone else works less, or not at all. This is how the French government used to believe the world worked, and it is wrong. Jobs are created any time an individual provides a new good or service, or finds a better or cheaper way of providing an old one. The numbers prove the point. The U.S. economy produced tens of millions of new jobs over the past three decades, including virtually the entire Internet sector. Yes, the recession that began in 2007 destroyed lots of jobs, too. Millions of women entered the labor force in the second half of the 20th century. Yet, our unemployment rate was still extremely low by historical standards until the beginning of the recent downturn. Similarly, huge waves of immigrants have come to work in America throughout our history without any long-run increase in unemployment. Are there short-term displacements? Absolutely. Some workers lose jobs or see their wages depressed when they're forced to compete with new entrants to the labor force. But more jobs are created than lost. Remember, new workers must spend their earnings elsewhere in the economy, creating new demand for other products. The economic pie gets bigger, not merely resliced. Here is the intuition. Imagine a farming community in which numerous families own and farm their own land. Each family produces just enough to feed itself. There is no surplus harvest or unfarmed land. Everyone in this town has enough to eat. On the other hand, no one lives particularly well. Every family spends large amounts of time doing domestic chores. They make their own clothes, teach their own children, make and repair their own farm implements, etc. Suppose a guy wanders into town looking for work. In scenario one, this guy has no skills. There is no extra land to farm, so the community tells him to get back on the train. Maybe they even buy him a one-way ticket out of town. This town has no jobs. Now consider scenario two. The guy who ambles into town has a Ph.D. in agronomy. He's designed a new kind of plow that improves corn yields. He trades his plow to farmers in exchange for a small share of their harvests. Everybody is better off. The agronomist can support himself. The farmers have more to eat, even after paying for their new plows, or else they wouldn't buy the plows. And this community has just created one new job. Plow salesman. Soon thereafter, a carpenter arrives at the train station. He offers to do all the odd jobs that limit the amount of time farmers can spend tending to their crops. Yields go up again, because farmers are able to spend more time doing what they do best, farming. And another new job is created. At this point, farmers are growing more than they can possibly eat themselves. So they spend their surplus to recruit a teacher to town. That's another new job. She teaches the children in the town, making the next generation of farmers better educated and more productive than their parents. Over time, our contrived farming town, which had no jobs at the beginning of this exercise, has romance novelists, firefighters, professional baseball players, and even engineers who design iPhones and margarita space packs. This is the one-page economic history of the United States. Rising levels of human capital enabled an agrarian nation to evolve into places as rich and complex as Manhattan and Silicon Valley. Not all is rosy along the way, of course. Suppose one of our newly educated farmers designs a plow that produces even better yields, putting the first plow salesman out of business. Creative destruction. True, this technological breakthrough eliminates one job in the short run. In the long run, though, the town is still better off. Remember, all the farmers are now richer, as measured by higher corn yields, enabling them to hire the unemployed agronomist to do something else, such as develop new hybrid seeds, which will make the town richer yet. Technology displaces workers in the short run, but does not lead to mass unemployment in the long run. Rather, we become richer, which creates demand for new jobs elsewhere in the economy. Of course, educated workers fare much better than uneducated workers in this process. They're more versatile in a fast-changing economy, making them more likely to be left standing after a bout of creative destruction. Human capital is about much more than earning more money. It makes us better parents, more informed voters, more appreciative of art and culture, more able to enjoy the fruits of life. It can make us healthier because we eat better and exercise more. Meanwhile, good health is an important component of human capital. Educated parents are more likely to put their children in car seats and teach them about colors and letters before they begin school. In the developing world, the impact of human capital can be even more profound. Economists have found that a year of additional schooling for a woman in a low-income country is associated with a 5 to 10% reduction in her child's likelihood of dying in the first 5 years of life. Similarly, our total stock of human capital, everything we know as a people, defines how well off we are as a society. We benefit from the fact that we know how to prevent polio or make stainless steel, even if virtually no one reading this book would be able to do either of those things if left stranded on a deserted island. Economist Gary Becker, who was awarded the Nobel Prize for his work in the field of human capital, reckons that the stock of education, training, skills, and even the health of people constitutes about 75% of the wealth of a modern economy. Not diamonds, buildings, oil, or fancy purses, but things that we carry around in our heads. We should really call our economy a human capitalist economy, for that is what it mainly is, Mr. Becker said in a speech. While all forms of capital, physical capital, such as machinery and plants, financial capital, and human capital are important, human capital is the most important. Indeed, in a modern economy, human capital is by far the most important form of capital in creating wealth and growth. There's a striking correlation between a country's level of human capital and its economic well-being. At the same time, there's a striking lack of correlation between natural resources and standard of living. Countries like Japan and Switzerland are among the richest in the world, despite having relatively poor endowments of natural resources. Countries like Nigeria are just the opposite. Enormous oil wealth has done relatively little for the nation's standard of living. In some cases, the mineral wealth of Africa has financed bloody civil wars that would have otherwise died out. In the Middle East, Saudi Arabia has most of the oil, while Israel, with no natural resources to speak of, has a higher per capita income. High levels of human capital create a virtuous cycle. Well-educated parents invest heavily in the human capital of their children. Low levels of human capital have just the opposite effect. Disadvantaged parents beget disadvantaged children, as any public school teacher will tell you. Mr. Becker points out, even small differences among children in the preparation provided by their families are frequently multiplied over time into large differences when they are teenagers. This is why the labor market cannot do much for school dropouts who can hardly read and never develop good work habits, and why it is so difficult to devise policies to help these groups. Why does human capital matter so much? To begin with, human capital is inextricably linked to one of the most important ideas in economics, productivity. Productivity is the efficiency with which we convert inputs into outputs. In other words, how good are we at making things? Does it take 2,000 hours for a Detroit auto worker to make a car, or 210 hours? Can an Iowa corn farmer grow 30 bushels of corn on an acre of land, or 210 bushels? The more productive we are, the richer we are. The reason is simple. The day will always be 24 hours long. The more we produce in those 24 hours, the more we consume, either directly or by trading it away for other stuff. Productivity is determined in part by natural resources. It's easier to grow wheat in Kansas than it is in Vermont. But in a modern economy, productivity is more affected by technology, specialization, and skills, all of which are a function of human capital. America is rich because Americans are productive. We're better off today than at any other point in the history of civilization because we're better at producing goods and services than we have ever been, including things like health care and entertainment. The bottom line is that we work less and produce more. In 1870, the typical household required 1,800 hours of labor just to acquire its annual food supply. Today, it takes about 260 hours of work. Over the course of the 20th century, the average work year has fallen from 3,100 hours to about 1,730 hours. All the while, real gross domestic product, or GDP, per capita, an inflation-adjusted measure of how much each of us produces on average, has increased from $4,800 to more than $40,000. Even the poor are living extremely well by historical standards. The poverty line is now at a level of real income that was attained only by those in the top 10% of the income distribution a century ago. As John Maynard Keynes once noted, in the long run, productivity is everything. Productivity is the concept that takes the suck out of Ross Perot's giant sucking sound. When Ross Perot ran for president in 1992 as an independent, one of his defining positions was opposition to the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Perot reasoned that if we opened our borders to free trade with Mexico, then millions of jobs would flee south of the border. Why wouldn't a firm relocate to Mexico when the average Mexican factory worker earns a fraction of the wages paid to American workers? The answer is productivity. Can American workers compete against foreign workers who earn half as much or less? Yes, most of us can. We produce more than Mexican workers, much more in many cases, because we're better educated, because we're healthier, because we have better access to capital and technology, and because we have more efficient government institutions and better public infrastructure. Can a Vietnamese peasant with 2 years of education do your job? Probably not. Of course, there are industries in which American workers are not productive enough to justify their relatively high wages, such as manufacturing textiles and shoes. These are industries that require relatively unskilled labor, which is more expensive in this country than in the developing world. Can a Vietnamese peasant sew basketball shoes together? Yes, and for a lot less than the American minimum wage. American firms will look to outsource jobs to other countries only if the wages in those countries are cheap relative to what those workers can produce. A worker who costs a tenth as much and produces a tenth as much is no great bargain. A worker who costs a tenth as much and produces half as much probably is. While Ross Perot was warning that most of the U.S. economy would migrate to Guadalajara, mainstream economists predicted that NAFTA would have a modest but positive effect on American employment. Some jobs would be lost to Mexican competition. More jobs would be created as exports to Mexico increased. We're now more than a decade into NAFTA, and that's exactly what happened. Economists reckon that the effect on overall employment was positive, albeit very small relative to the size of the U.S. economy. Will our children be better off than we are? Yes, if they're more productive than we are, which has been the pattern throughout American history. Productivity growth is what improves our standard of living. If productivity grows at 2% a year, then we'll become 2% richer every year. Why? Because we can take the same input